So when we're talking about police abolition, we're talking about going back to the root diagnosis, saying, what are the problems society faces? And if we name what those problems are, how many people would suggest that what we need is a 19th century paramilitary militia set up to enforce racism? Probably no one.
What might our society look like if we abolished militarized policing and replaced it with systems of care and mutual support? This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. We are taught to believe that the systems of our society are there to protect us. But many aspects of our society, like policing, are in fact modern versions of systems built to enforce racism and white supremacy. Today, I'm talking about police abolition with artist and activist Ricardo Levins Morales. Ricardo helps us see the deep, troubled history of policing and links today's movement for police abolition to the unfinished business that is the abolition of slavery and racism. This conversation dramatically changed how I see the issue. Let's dig in. I am so happy to welcome back Ricardo Levins Morales to this show. Ricardo was an artist and activist in Minnesota who previously joined me on episode 3 for a conversation about activism. Today, Ricardo is here to talk about the end of policing as we know it. This is an area that is immensely important to Ricardo and to me, and I am very excited to have him here to take us through it. Ricardo, hi, and thanks for coming back to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here and glad to be vicariously in Canada, our neighbor to the north.
Ricardo, as you know, I've planned from the very start of this show to do an episode on police abolition. This show is about helping other people envision changes that they might think are radical. And because it can be hard to imagine what's on the other side of a paradigm shift. And when we hear slogans like defund the police and police abolition, this is one of those changes, at least in my experience, that people just can't envision for whatever reason, they misunderstand. So can you tell me what you mean when you say or hear police abolition?
Well, first of all, I want to say that when we talk about the abolition of systems of policing, that actually is radical. You know, and I mean that in the most positive sense, that it comes from the belief that it takes more than just tweaking an existing system, or at least this particular existing system, to make it become something that it isn't. The policing has shown that even when it's subjected to all kinds of reforms and oversight and all of these other measures, civilian review, it always eventually defaults back to its factory settings. So, you know, when we're talking about radical solutions, we have to understand that meaningful solutions tend to be radical. At the time of the original abolition movement against slavery in the United States, the prevailing view was that slavery, even among the white people who opposed it, that it was really not something that you could eliminate. You might be able to reform it, but it's been here entrenched for hundreds of years. Our society wouldn't be able to function without it. We can make it more humane, maybe limit the hours that enslaved people have to work or the age at which they need to begin working as children, but you're not going to get rid of it. And it took radicals like Frederick Douglass, who insisted on a vision of complete equality without any limits or qualifications, to move that agenda. And it was, you know, kind of a shocking thing to be saying, you know, and, you know, it's so shocking, you've got to be careful, it might alienate the liberals and your potential supporters, because you really need to deal with where they're at.
But how do you do that? How do you meet people, allies, where they are, but also help them see that radical change is critical and that reform is a half measure at best, or frankly, no measure at all?
It depends on what we have to start with the diagnosis. What are the police? The defenders of the police system say, well, the police are here to keep us safe. they're not doing a great job, but that's what they're here for. And 99% of cops are good people who just want to help. And they're very upset that the few bad apples give them a bad name. Now, those are significant claims to make, and those making them never reveal what the knowledge base is that they're basing that on. Whereas those of us who have been working on police abolition have grounded it in in-depth research on the history and the functioning of policing.
Can you give us a primer on that history?
It's different, you know, somewhat different with the RCMP in Canada, but so I'm speaking from a United States perspective, but that the system was put in place largely to make sure that emancipated Black people did not win actual freedom after slavery was abolished. And it was done through a system of criminalizing, where almost anything a Black person did, they could be arrested for violating the Black laws and imprisoned and then leased back out to plantation owners and factory owners. And that once they have a record, then they're excluded from education, housing, good jobs, et cetera. In other words, it's very similar to the role that police play today. And despite 150 years of attempted reforms, that hasn't changed. So when we're talking about police reform, or rather police abolition, we're talking about going back to the root diagnosis, saying what are the problems society faces? And if we name what those problems are, what are the challenges facing our communities? How many people would suggest that what we need is a 19th century paramilitary militia set up to enforce racism? Probably no one. So that gives us the freedom to use our imagination and think, well, what are the things that actually might solve these problems? Where are the places and communities where there are people who intervene and solve these problems? How do they do it? What are the models from other societies? And what are the conditions that keep getting generated and generated and generated that cause people to behave in ways that now are answered by the police?
It strikes me in that answer that you're talking about the people advocating for police abolition or advocating to replace a system that's a very different system, I think, than many people might have in their minds when they're arguing the other point, that we need the police, or maybe talking past each other to an extent. And that brings us to what are police, what are we telling ourselves police are for, or what are the services that we need in our communities and neighborhoods to be and feel safe and to manage conflict? And then why in the world would we want to have people who have a weaponized force be the force that is de-escalating and helping us manage conflict? And an outsider, an alien would see that and just think that was absurd.
Yeah, well, I think that most listeners would probably be able to notice that de-escalating conflict and police coexist uncomfortably in the same sentence. That's generally not their function. But I think you're right that we're talking about two different underlying sets of assumptions, because on one level, I agree with the defenders of the police in the sense that if we take as a given that we are going to continue having a system that sends billionaires into space while hungry children sleep on the street, where housing is in the hands of developers who really only want to make condos for rich people, where, you know, food systems are in the hands of chemical companies, et cetera, you know, if we see these increasing dysfunction and the siphoning away of wealth from the natural environment and from communities, well, yes, absolutely. You need a military or a paramilitary force to keep people from either getting upset or committing, you know, survival type crimes to get by, because those are the inevitable results of such a system. Right now, and there's also another byproduct of the system. It happens to be threatening life on Earth, which probably shouldn't go unmentioned. So, yes, once we're talking about eliminating the police system as we know it, that raises a lot of other questions. Because you say, why do people end up calling 911? You know, who are you going to call when someone's banging on your back window in the alley, right? Who are you going to call when there's gunshots down the street? And we have to ask, why are those things happening? what kind of resources can be directed in ways that don't involve guns to create resourced communities, because adequate resources allow people to have an adequate relationship with their environment, right? You know, good schools, green spaces, healthy food, agency over one's work life. For some reason, those are non-starters under our current system, but they need to be if we want to solve the problems that policing are supposedly there to solve.
Earlier, you made a point, I think indirectly, about how important it is to think about this movement, not just about the present and the future, but how it's rooted in this history. And one of the things I take from that is that the abolition movement then also becomes not just about changing the systems of care and safety in our communities moving forward, but also about acknowledging, recognizing, and doing something about the long history of injustices that the systems of policing that we currently have caused. Is that right?
Have caused or are caused by, mm-hmm. You know, there's a relationship between them. But yeah, I mean, you said something very radical. Now, just mentioning the term systems of care, we think of those as far as mental health interventions or education, helping people who are unhoused on the street. But what if all systems were systems of care? Mm-hmm. What if food were grown to feed people and to keep them as healthy as possible? What if housing were simply created on the basis of what would make people's lives better? These are shocking ideas, right? We have become so accustomed to systems where that is sidelined or treated as unreasonable, illogical, or naive. And in fact, there's a tremendous amount of financial resources poured into sort of ideological combat to make those ideas seem absurd.
One of the things that's on my mind in this conversation is the recent violence, racially motivated shootings in Buffalo, and for all of my life, the inability of our society to do something meaningful about gun violence. And it strikes me in this conversation that these are in the same room together. Our inability to do something about the violent system that we have for supposedly creating safety, and also the inability to do something as a society about access to weapons of death. Does that resonate for you at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it a little differently than in terms of inability. That's a word that's worth interrogating. For example, when we talk about getting guns off the street, people refer to there being a lack of will. I don't think there's a lack of will. I think there's an overabundance of won't, right?
Yeah.
And that's the same with climate change. The American Petroleum Institute organizing a vast consortium of multinational corporations fought hard to prevent the idea of climate change from being taken seriously, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not as though there are not solutions to the issues of the changing climate. And of course, in the 1970s, when they began, it would have been a lot easier. Now we have a lot more damage to try to mitigate. But it's not that there are not solutions readily available in all of these areas mm-hmm. that cause our people to suffer. The problem is that we're actually, despite the kind of liberal rhetoric, we don't actually all want the same thing. And that's the problem. That needs to be put into stark relief to understand that there are interests that take different positions on these things. I mean, in the case of the police, they really stepped in this country in the 1920s to take on the role that the Ku Klux Klan, which was then in decline, had played previously. And that is maintaining a certain base level of terror in Black communities. So the incarceration machine, the criminalization, all of these things could maintain economic inequality, right? So then when we're sitting down at the table to try to figure out what to do, how to solve these problems, it's a mistake to think that all of the people involved in the issue, the so-called stakeholders, actually want the same outcome.
Right. In an earlier answer, you mentioned you said we need to think about why people are calling 911. I wonder, for the purposes of imagining an alternative universe to the one we're in now, do you have an example of a kind of conflict today that somebody might call 911 for that we could be handling in a completely fundamentally different way that wouldn't require, obviously, that doesn't require a militarized police force?
I think that in all cases, we would benefit by calling some kind of, if we needed to call in assistance, trained assistance, that it be something that doesn't look anything like the current police. So I've heard that most calls actually have to do with mental health or traffic stops, right? And traffic stops are always on a racialized basis, right? So in that sense, they're not actually law enforcement. They're actually criminal acts. When the people are stopped on the basis of race, that violates the Constitution and legislation in this country. But so mental health, clearly school discipline. Cops are being called into high schools and grade schools only when dark-skinned kids act up. Bus fare violations, or you know, people jumping turnstiles on the trains. But also in cases that are more polarizing, where you actually might need somebody who is skilled at the use of force. But what we need are people who are fundamentally trained in the ethics of helping people. And additionally, it's the same with EMTs. You know, the cops are often the first to arrive when there's a car accident or an injury or whatever, right? And then they often escalate and politicize and racialize the situation. And if the medical, you know, emergency medical services arrive, they immediately are under the authority of whatever police is on the scene. At a minimum, that should be reversed. Better to have teams of people, whether they're social workers, medical workers, et cetera, community volunteers who are skilled in de-escalating and in helping people, and have maybe someone on their team who is able to take a lead on the situation if it really calls for trying to subdue somebody by force. You know, and this was the case in, I was just actually reading about somebody more from your area, the Plains Cree Chief Poundmaker in the 1880s. And that was in a system that existed in a lot of Indigenous America, where he was the chief of the tribe, unless the situation really called for a more robust physical response, in which case the war chief would sort of take charge of the logistics of the situation.
It occurs to me, thinking about this conversation and thinking back to our first podcast interview where we talked about activism and learning about how to be more effective at pursuing change. You know, you live in Minnesota, you live and work in Minnesota, and so you experienced firsthand, I imagine, the protests and fallout of the violent killing of George Floyd. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Our shop is three blocks down the street from the police precinct that was burned to the ground 2 years ago.
Would you share a little bit about something you've taken away or learned from those events when it comes to being effective at achieving change? Because that really did elevate the conversation nationally, right? Still does evoke a lot for a lot of people. Could you tell me a little bit about what you've taken away from that?
Now, I want to backtrack a little bit here and talk a little about, because I mentioned the work that I've been involved with here, and it's relevant to your question. Starting in 2016, a group of us came together during protests against another police killing at that time, Jamar Clark. Mark Clark was a police killing in the 1960s. Noticing a little piece of history, that was 2016. The police were founded here in 1867, which meant that the following year would be their 150th anniversary. And so we thought, oh, they've never had a performance review. You know, maybe it's time to give them a performance review and an evaluation and see if they should be upped again for another 150 years. And that ended up pulling together a group. At the peak, there were about 5 dozen people working in different working groups, doing historical research, interviewing social service people, collecting on the street interviews, researching alternatives to policing. And we put out a report that year on their anniversary, basically with our 5 essential findings, including what I've summarized, sort of the role, function, historical of the police, and the historical failure of reforms. That the reform cycle is one that you can, you know, we made a graph of it, you know, where there's a police crime, there's outrage, there's calls for reform, reforms are put in place, there's another police crime after the reforms erode over a couple of years, and the cycle keeps continuing. It's a way to keep people distracted and busy. So we put out that report, and not handing it to policymakers and higher ups and the media, but to communities, distributing copies all throughout communities. We made an audiobook of it. We made an exhibit, which went up in one of the most over-policed communities in the city, had workshops on alternative policing, spoke to college and elementary and high school classes. So this had been going on for about 3 years at the time George Floyd was murdered. So that conversations in the media, in schools, et cetera, already the language of abolition, which when we started out was crazy talk. I mean, ha, 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 what a joke. By the time that George Floyd was murdered, it had saturated into enough places in the community that it was able to come out in that moment, right?
Ricardo, I feel like you're giving us a masterclass right now on how you change narrative, how you prime the pump to change people's minds.
You know, one of the things that, you know, always comes up is, well, how do you change people's minds, right? And one of the ways you do that is by truth-telling, coming up with the narrative and helping people ask the right questions. You know, we had the experience, we were doing a series of events called Coffee with an Abolitionist, because the police were having coffee with a cop sessions in coffee houses. So we, you know, worked it out with coffee houses all over the city to have coffee with an abolitionist days. And people would come and talk to us about the ideas. And we found, much to our surprise, that people who came in very resistant, by the time they left the conversation, they weren't saying, okay, necessarily I'm convinced, but okay, at least I have to take your ideas seriously. I'll have to think about that. I never thought about it that way before. Because most of the people who come argue against the police abolition do so without ever having looked at anything that we've said, any of the materials, any of the history. They're just responding in a knee-jerk way to the propaganda that the police put out. Oh, well, if you get rid of police, then all of a sudden the streets will be rampant with criminality. You know, there'll be shootings on every corner. This is the most naive idea I ever heard of. Yeah, you're right. And of course, nobody ever actually is saying that. Transitions are necessary. So the idea that you wave your magic wand and make something disappear that people have been depending on, not necessarily depending on it rightfully, but depending on it nonetheless. They've monopolized the resources for certain kinds of issues such that there is nobody else to turn to in many cases. And that absolutely has to be remedied. We need to begin shifting resources away from the police into community spaces that have the skills, but not the legacy.
Thank you for that answer. I appreciate you anticipated my next question, which was about how do you get people to start to see the issue differently when they're starting from a, you know, that's absurd or what, you know, just as you said. So thanks. That was a great transition. Ricardo, I've really enjoyed this. Again, I appreciate this. This is a very hard concept for people to connect with, and hopefully this conversation helps a little bit. I asked you this last time you were here. I ask everybody this, but I want to ask you again, focusing specifically on this topic. Is there something particular in this movement that you would like to see unfold, something that you think is key that maybe we're close to?
Well, I mean, I think at this stage in the movement, this is a long haul movement. This is not there's no short fix on this. And anybody expecting one will be disappointed. It's going to take a while, and it goes through ebbs and flows, right? So really, I mean, I think one of the things we need is people organizing in ways that will sustain them for the long haul. That partly has to do with education, understanding the functioning of police and all the ways we're connected to other struggles. Because if we think about it in the way that I've described, it means that people fighting for housing justice, people fighting for good nutrition for young people, you know, as well as those wanting to address mental illness and so forth, we all have common cause. We're all dealing with problems that have the same root cause. Right now, there are a lot of different things being tried out in different cities, in different towns, in different places, as it should be. This is a period of experimentation. In some places, people are organizing alternative 911 organizations where people will respond to certain types of emergencies on an emergency switchboard basis in a nonviolent way. And those are sort of, you know, some of them are actually operational for certain set times of the week, certain days of the week, and they're sort of experimenting. Others are working on city budgets, trying to have funds transferred. You know, and to be realistic, we're in a time where the power of police is actually increasing. That's, you know, we might be starting to have an impact on the level of narrative, but certainly the system is not in retreat. Actually, they're getting more sophisticated surveillance equipment, more sophisticated, criminalization of protests and all of these things. Right? So, you know, we're going through a period which is very contradictory, that even as the movement grows, the other side grows. So I think really at this moment, what the pundits and the corporations and the police want the movement to do more than anything else is to go away. You'll notice this in all of these smug articles and lectures and stories that are put out there saying, well, the abolition movement, you know, it came on the scene, it blazed out, now it's gone, thank goodness, now it's time for responsible people to take over. And that's what they say in every movement that starts to, make an impact and hit a nerve. And it's absolutely not the case, but it shows how desperately they understand that it's simply the sustainability of the movement is what makes it the greatest threat.
That makes a lot of sense. Ricardo, thank you for that. And thank you for this conversation. As I really appreciate it. It's helped me understand how to talk about and think about this and to contribute to it. So I'm grateful for that.
I'd like to sort of end with a quote I just dug up from Frederick Douglass. Again, slavery is a good reference point because the police really are part of the unfinished business of that movement. And Douglass argued, in fact, that slavery was unreformable. He says, the apologists for slavery often speak of the abuses of slavery, and they tell us that they are as much opposed to those abuses as we are, and that they would go as far to correct those abuses and to ameliorate the condition of the slave as anybody. The answer to that view is that slavery itself is an abuse, that it lives by abuse and dies by the lack of abuse. And I think that if you switched in the word police for slavery, you'd understand both the continuity and the basic argument of the abolition movement.
Thank you for that. I appreciate you thinking and taking the time to pull that quote out. I really do. This is the Second Transition podcast. Today, I spoke with Ricardo Levins Morales, an activist and artist in Minneapolis, Minnesota. More information about Ricardo and his work is available in the episode notes. This episode of the Second Transition podcast was produced on the traditional lands and treaty territories of the Mississaugas of the Credit, also known as the Dish with One Spoon Territory. The Second Transition podcast was produced with support from the Arrow Food Institute and from Voice Ed Canada. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.